This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
More than 2 million subprime mortgages are scheduled to reset in the coming months. That sparked a blame game and a search for solutions. Today's edition of Subprime All the Time features both relief and reproach. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, the 5th day of December. The subpoenas are apparently flying out of the office of New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. Today's Wall Street Journal reports he's added Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley and other Wall Street firms to a list that already includes Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and Washington Mutual. Cuomo is looking into the relationships among mortgage issuers, investment banks, and credit agencies and their role in the subprime crisis. Meanwhile, that mortgage relief the White House has been promising is on the way. Word today that a plan now is in place to freeze interest rates for some homeowners. Marketplace's Jill Barchet is here to explain. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Tess.
So we have news that there is a deal. President Bush will outline the details tomorrow. But what do we know so far?
The Treasury Department's been working on this with the major mortgage lenders in the country. And what we understand is that they're going to be freezing the rates on subprime loans for about 5 years. These are the loans that start out at those low teaser rates. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about the ones that will start to reset after January 1st of next year. There's going to be 450,000 of these mortgages every quarter. And the assumption is that one-fourth of these people can't pay when they reset. So they want to freeze it at the low rate that they are paying right now for the next 5 years. There's going to be no taxpayer dollars used. And the other wrinkle to it is that not everyone is going to get this freeze. Only the people who can't afford the higher rate but are making payments at their low teaser rates.
How do they determine who that is? I mean, are they going to go through and look at everybody's mortgage payment?
They're going to try to rapidly put people in a bunch of different buckets. Hmm. So, for example, if you're unemployed and you're already late on your payments, your house will probably go into foreclosure. And if they determine that you're wealthy, and a lot of good borrowers were put into these expensive subprime loans, they're going to have you jack up to the higher rate. But if they can find the people who are current but still risky, poor credits, those are the people who will get frozen into the low rate.
Hmm. Well, there has been a lot of opposition coming out over the last few days to this plan. And let's start, first of all, with fellow borrowers, people who actually, got decent loans who are looking at the subprime borrowers getting this deal and saying, hey, that's not fair.
Exactly. You're going to have people who are neighbors, both with the same Prius, and one guy's going to be able to keep his mortgage at a lower 7 or 8% rate, and the other one's going to jump up in January to 11%, and they might have had a mortgage with the same company.
Hmm. But the vocal opposition is really coming from Wall Street. Why? Why do investors not like this plan?
So you have all these investors who own securities that are backed by these subprime mortgages, and they were expecting to get payments based on the higher interest rates that the mortgages were going to jump up to. And if the mortgages don't jump up to those higher rates, that means they're going to get much lower payments.
All right, who else is upset?
What's really interesting, Tess, is that the biggest opposition we're seeing right now are from people who don't even own these mortgage securities. There are a lot of hedge funds and Wall Street desks out there that have taken out short positions against the mortgage market, betting that the mortgage securities will go down. And every time you have more foreclosures, the value of their short positions goes up. So what this Paulson plan would mean, would there be fewer foreclosures? And these short guys, these short sellers would lose money.
All right, Marketplace's Jill Barshay joining us from our New York bureau. Thanks, Jill.
My pleasure.
One of the most popular videos on YouTube today, at least at the moment I checked, is a clip of a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? But you can pretty much guarantee that the game show distributor did not give permission for that clip to appear on the site. Producers of all kinds of TV programming are fighting what some argue is a losing battle against pirated video online. But as of today, there's a new sheriff for hire. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports.
The TV ratings company Nielsen is planning a new service to put an end to those pirated clips. The idea is to digitally watermark video so owners can control whether it gets used online. Bruce Davis is CEO of Digimark, Nielsen's partner in the venture. He says the new system is not just a way for Hollywood to safeguard its content, it's also a way to make more money from it by attaching advertising to the clips people use.
So say it's a clip from a television show. You could have some commentary on the show, some fan club stuff, some merchandise, all kinds of things.
James McQuivy of Forrester Research says Nielsen needs a new trick up its sleeve. The company's been struggling to reinvent itself in a world where old-fashioned television is increasingly trumped by the net.
Up until now, they've had a monopoly on measuring people's consumption of video, and now that so much video consumption is going to the internet, they're losing a hold on a monopoly. And there's one thing a monopoly doesn't want, which is to lose its monopoly.
Some analysts say Nielsen has a better shot at selling itself as a video cop than less neutral players like YouTube, which has also been creating its own digital watermarking system. Tech analyst Om Malik says the Nielsen plan is a nice idea, but
whether they can actually make it work, I am not that convinced about that.
Malik says you can put a lock on content, but it'll be impossible to completely squelch the multi-billion dollar piracy problem. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
U.S. presidential contenders aren't the only ones campaigning around this country. One of the leading candidates for president of South Africa is here, lobbying for business partnerships and investment. He's shaken off rape charges and corruption allegations in his home country, but he has yet to make peace with the international business community. From Johannesburg, Gretchen Wilson has the story.
Jacob Zuma, the frontrunner to lead South Africa's ruling party, has a strong support base among the poor. They cheer him in rallies around the country.
Zuma! Zuma!
He's also backed by trade unions and the Communist Party, which tends to ring alarm bells for international investors. Which is why Zuma's been in Austin, Texas, assuring U.S. retailers and investment institutions that he won't threaten South Africa's economic stability. Not everyone's buying it. Ross Herbert is with the South African Institute of International Affairs. He says unions and the Communist Party feel sidelined by government's focus on privatization and free trade.
They've been particularly disaffected in recent years, feeling that the government was too in favor of liberalization and open markets and not activist enough in terms of creating jobs and protecting jobs from foreign imports.
He says these groups are likely to expect paybacks for supporting Zuma's campaign, like higher taxes on U.S. and Chinese imports to protect the local textile industry. But at a recent briefing with Merrill Lynch, Zuma backs South Africa's fiscally sound economic policies. So some analysts say jitters over Zuma are exaggerated. Dale McKinley is a political analyst in Johannesburg.
If someone's looking and saying, well, my goodness, if Jacob Zuma becomes the next president of South Africa, that economic policy is going to change. No, it's not going to happen.
McKinley says that the core ANC leadership continues to support market-friendly policies. In the 13 years since apartheid rule, South Africa's economy has flourished, with GDP growing at about 5%. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, investors cheered some positive reports about the economy. Details when we do the numbers. Today in Florida, top collectors are getting a sneak peek at the works of more than 2,000 artists. It's preview day at Art Basel Miami Beach, the biggest art fair in the country. It kicks off a week of swank parties and exhibits of art for sale from more than 200 galleries. The art market has experienced what some are calling a price bubble for the last several years. All kinds of records being set at auctions and private sales. We asked Lisa Austin, a fine art consultant, to join us with the latest from the art world. And Lisa, tell us first a little more about Art Basel Miami Beach. What's its provenance?
Art Basel is actually a fair that started in Switzerland somewhere around 37 years ago. And at that point, it was a fairly small affair, really made for connoisseurs and people who were into collecting long term. It was a small world back then. Art Basel Miami Beach is really a phenomenon. It started about 5 years ago, 6 years ago at this point. And since then, it's really taken over as sort of the major event worldwide.
Well, it has been a couple of crazy years in the art market. And I understand that a lot of that is kind of new entrants into the market, hedge fund managers, newly wealthy folks, and also that there's a new phenomenon of flipping where you don't hold on to the painting, but you just buy it to sell it.
Well, that's very true. I mean, I think whenever you get Wall Street involved, you're looking at people who are used to trading. And the idea is that if a piece of art goes well at auction or there seems to be a buzz about that artist's work, then there are a lot of people on the sidelines who sort of jump in and kind of follow the trajectory of that artist's work and say, this is something that I should be looking at and buying. And those are the people who have really skewed the market by buying and then flipping and then reselling. And then those people that were unable to get a hold of the art from galleries, the show was all sold out, then they come into the auction market and say, wow, there's that piece. I couldn't get a hold of it. It's my chance to get it.
So how does that affect collectors who are wanting to buy the art to actually put it on the wall in their homes?
Well, a lot of collectors who are mere millionaires instead of billionaires are actually priced out of the market because they see works that maybe they saw for $50,000 at a show go for $300,000 at auction. And that is not unusual. That's actually, you know, something that's been fairly common over the past 5 years.
I think there was some speculation this year about whether the economy would in turn have an impact on how the art market was doing. But it doesn't seem like any of the problems in the economy have trickled, I won't say down, but perhaps up into the art market. Things are going really strong.
Really strong, which is somewhat surprising, considering that the rest of the economy seems pretty jittery.
Right.
And I think there was a little blip in the screen with the Sotheby's Impressionist and Modern Auction a couple of months ago, and everybody was saying, gosh, this must be it. But it turned out not to be it, and the contemporary auctions, which were just a week later, were very, very strong. But there is this sort of black cloud hanging around the art market, which is, how long will this boom last, and when will we see the effects of the credit crunch and the subprime markets and all the other things that are sort of shaking up our economy?
Well, you know, we've seen record after record fall over just the last couple of years. And in fact, records for Koons and Matisse works just last month. At some point, is this going to top out?
Well, I definitely think there is a top. At some point, if the prices go high enough, then the market for people who are able to buy them is shrinking. And so you're just going to have billionaires selling to other billionaires. You'll notice that a lot of dealers are buying back works at auction. In the last couple of auctions, there were dealers that were jumping in to protect the market. I think that we're at probably the very end or close to the end of this five-year boom.
Lisa Austin is a fine art advisor and founder of the art consulting firm Lisa Austin and Associates. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Congress is still debating the energy bill that would boost fuel economy standards on cars and trucks, but environmentalists aren't waiting around for that to happen. They've been pushing car companies to develop cleaner, more efficient vehicles for years. Hybrids are already on the road, cars with both an electric motor that recharges and a gas engine. The next step? Plug-in hybrids that use even less gasoline. Well, they're here. Sort of. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explains.
Good morning, everyone, and a sincere thanks for taking
That's
time out Toyota of your
That's Toyota exec Bob Carter at U.S. headquarters in Torrance, California. Toyota has summoned reporters to what Carter calls a momentous occasion.
First Toyota plug-in hybrids here in the U.S.
But make that a grand total of two. The Japanese automaker has modified the Prius as a plug-in gasoline electric vehicle, but it's not selling the car. It's handing these test vehicles over to researchers at two California universities for further study.
There are still many questions to be answered, and we have many challenges to be resolved before we can bring these products to market. And they have to have the quality, durability, and reliability that our consumers expect from us.
The big automakers aren't ready to roll out these next generation of eco cars anytime soon. In fact, Toyota won't even set a release date. The company says the batteries aren't up to snuff and it wants more research on consumer expectations, just for a start. Rival GM is advertising a plug-in hybrid.
Do you hear that?
It's humming.
Oh, that's no ordinary hum. That's the sound of the future.
GM may have an ad for the Chevy Volt, but its plug-in car isn't on the market either. GM is revving up interest in the car, but says the lithium-ion battery it needs is still under development. It won't be ready before 2010 at the earliest. Other car companies, like Honda and Nissan, talk more about making all-electric vehicles someday, but that, too, depends on the perfect battery. LA Times auto critic Dan Neal says Honda and Nissan are perhaps more optimistic that Americans will embrace a car that doesn't go as far as a hybrid, but it's a gamble.
The issue is really getting to the psychology of American buyers to say, you don't need all this car all the time. Americans have trouble with that because we think of automobiles as Conestoga wagons that we get in with all our possessions and go to the hinterland.
That's why clean car activists like Felix Kramer see such promise in plug-ins that go further. His California-based group CalCars.org set up camp across the street from the LA Auto Show recently and converted a Prius into a plug-in on their own. Kramer says he was sending car makers a message. Get moving.
We don't think the car makers understand a business concept that almost every other industry understands, which is versioning. If we had waited on cell phones, when they started, they were the size of a brick and they weighed too much and they were extremely expensive. But it didn't stop cell makers from making those phones and getting them better and better.
Kramer says perfect is often the enemy of the good. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, imagine cutting the price of a tank of gas in half.
It's nice. You drive to the beach, drive to the mountains, drive to the country, and we don't really stress about it anymore.
But first, let's do the numbers. Positive employment news boosted stocks today on Wall Street. The Dow jumped 196 points, 1.5%, to close at 13,444. The Nasdaq gained 46 points, 1.75%, to finish at 2666. The S&P added 22 points, 1.5%, to wrap up at 1485. Tech stocks led the march upwards. Higher prices for memory chips sent Intel up 3.5%. Ditto for Micron Technology, which closed up more than 4%. Even housing related stocks couldn't inflict their usual pain on investors. Countrywide Financial gained more than 4%. American International Group jumped almost 5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 3.94%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. Gas the Hog and Hit the Highway. The Motorcyclist Advisory Council meets in Washington to discuss road safety. USA to Pakistan is the top agenda item at a Senate Economic Affairs Committee hearing. And an event that's been called a Feast of Superlatives kicks off in Amsterdam. The Millionaires' Fair rolls out the latest in swimming pools, cars, yachts, and diamonds. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. The dollar gained ground against other major currencies today after a better-than-expected report on private sector job growth here in the U.S., but it has been a tough year for the greenback. So tough, in fact, that Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul has suggested a return to the gold standard. Commentator David Frum says that's a really bad idea.
With anti-Federal Reserve crusader Ron Paul polling almost 10% among New Hampshire Republicans, a once zany question has taken on some spasms of life. Should the United States return to the gold standard? For most of the period from 1789 to 1933, the dollar was fixed to gold, 20 bucks to the ounce. If something positive or negative happened in the U.S. economy, the dollar could not adjust up or down the way it does today against the euro, the yen, or the pound. A recession was like a car accident without bumpers or crumple zones. Riders in the cabin felt the pain full on. Domestic asset values collapsed. Unemployment jumped. Homes were lost. Businesses disappeared. Since ending dollar-gold convertibility in 1933, the United States economy has experienced ever fewer and shallower recessions. Since 1982, we have enjoyed a quarter century of almost uninterrupted growth with low inflation. Now, though, the United States is in the midst of a huge rebalancing of its external accounts. The dollar is declining. As the dollar buys less abroad, Americans will be constrained to consume fewer foreign goods and services, and foreigners will be induced to buy more from Americans. With luck, this process will occur without a recession. This is what happened in 1985-86, the last such rebalancing. There are three things one would want a monetary policy to do. You can do any two of these three things, but never all three at once. You can keep the domestic purchasing power of money stable. Or you can keep your currency stable relative to other currencies. Or you can allow money to flow freely across borders. Today we choose domestic price stability plus capital freedom. That still seems the right choice. But there are other choices, including the old-fashioned choice favored by Dr. Paul, the one that says that when it's time for an economy to make an adjustment, the adjustment should be felt, good and hard.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President Bush. He's now a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We always appreciate your feedback. Go to marketplace.com and click on contact. Oil dropped below $88 a barrel today, despite an announcement by OPEC that it will hold the line on production. Not much consolation if you're headed to the pump and staring at prices well over $3 a gallon. Well, in Australia, they have the option of filling up at half the price with LPG, liquid propane gas. Stuart Cohen reports from Sydney.
Okay, here you get. Well, let's go pick up Cohen.
Yes, thank
you.
Lise Kerrigan drives one of the more than half million cars in Australia that run on liquid propane, also called autogas. For her and her husband Ohan, spending the money to convert the car from petrol to autogas was a no-brainer.
Big savings. We used to
fill up, it was about $90 a week for a 75-litre tank. Now it costs us $35 for about 2 weeks on the gas, going from $90 to $35. There's just no questions asked.
Kerrigan says the savings have taken the cost of filling up out of the family's weekly budget equation.
$20 versus $45. It's a day trip. It's really affordable for a family. So it's nice. You drive to the beach, drive to the mountains, drive to the country, and we don't really stress about it anymore, whereas before we really had to consider a budget. Oh, we can afford this much per week.
Australia has managed to do what the US hasn't, successfully deliver, everywhere in the country, a cleaner-burning alternative fuel. And for roughly $2 a gallon versus $5 for gasoline, at a huge savings. That's something that'll have to happen in the States if there's any hope of having ethanol or hydrogen overtake gasoline as the fuel of choice among consumers.
Now, over and above that, the federal government recently offered an incentive. They make available $2,000 for people that want to convert their existing vehicle over to LPG, or if they're purchasing a factory LPG vehicle, there's a $1,000 grant available.
Phil Westlake is with LPG Australia, the industry's trade association. He says while American drivers might worry about things like, say, accidentally blowing themselves up while working with high-pressure liquefied gases, that fear is unfounded.
The only difference is that you've got a screw-on connection, so it's a matter of just pushing the nozzle against the connection, screwing that on, and then when you release the nozzle, you'll hear a small discharge of gas, and that's just releasing the gas between the connection, the nozzle and the connection.
And that's just fine with car owner Lise Carrigan.
My 9-year-old could do it if he was allowed. He's just not allowed. Legally, he can't.
Industry insiders say the recent concern about global warming has helped accelerate the popularity of autogas.
Tailpipe emissions, typically for autogas, they can be up to 80% less than petrol.
Roger Promnant runs Vital Gas, one of Australia's major wholesalers of LPG. He says instead of trying to reinvent the wheel, the industry got a jump start by piggybacking on the existing network of petrol stations around the country.
People are familiar with obviously pulling onto service stations to get fuel. This is a different type of fuel on the same site. The fact that LPG trucks are already out around delivering to the traditional segment, you know, home heating, meant that it was not a difficult step to then having also delivered to service stations.
Car owner Lise Carrigan says between the government rebate and her savings at the pump, she expects to recoup the $4,000 cost of her conversion in less than a year. And she gets a warm, fuzzy feeling doing something good for the environment, too. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at shrinersforkids.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, last month we reported the online social networking site Facebook would be rolling out a plan to improve how it advertised customers. Well, you could say it's done an about-face on that plan. Through something called the Beacon Program, Facebook was tracking its users' purchases on other websites. Then it publicized those purchases so all your friends could see you bought your wife a diamond ring for Christmas on Overstock.com. Some customers weren't exactly happy about all that disclosure. Facebook now says it will allow users to permanently turn off the beacon. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow scooped up 196 points, 1.5%. The Nasdaq sailed ahead 46 points, 1.75%. And the S&P added 20 points. That's 1.5%. Our engineers include Ravi Carman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbernoni, Eric Johnson, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns. Next time on the program, real estate brokers sway to the subprime blues.
All the buyers are on the sidelines. It's like a really bad junior high dance. And no one's doing anything. Everyone's just standing around.
I'm Tess Viglund. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.